sex in a single cell. First off, I'm sure you're all familiar with the term of virus, and you use it rather freely and say you have a virus, and which may mean anything from a cold to an upset stomach to a fever to a sore throat or this kind of thing. We've known about virus for some time, actually perhaps several hundred years, but we haven't called it virus, this kind of thing, and we haven't known really what kind of a organism, let's put it that way, that a virus is. Back in the late 1800s, perhaps the first real experiment done with virus was done by a Russian who was studying the tobacco mosaic disease. This is a disease caused by a virus. It doesn't particularly harm the plants, but it does cause a mottling of the leaves. And it's rather obvious to see if the plant does have this disease. At this time, in the 1890s, they knew a bit about bacteria. They knew that if you had a solution in which bacteria were present, if you filtered that solution, the filtrate then would be completely free of bacteria, and so would be innocent, sterile. So the person that was studying this disease may try this experiment in which he filtered the sap from this diseased plant to see if it contained bacteria, or what they called germs at that time. Interestingly enough, he found that after he filtered the sap and then injected the filtrate, in other words, this liquid that went through the filter paper, injected this into another plant, he discovered that the disease still was transmitted to the plant, that somehow this liquid still contained this poisonous, noxious, unknown substance. It was this time that they used the term virus, and virus means noxious liquid, meaning harmful liquid. This time they had no idea what a virus was. It was something very, very mysterious that could creep through the filter. And even in their early 20s, you heard, and perhaps even 30s, you heard the term filterable virus. We did not know at this time what a virus was. We just knew that it could go through a filter paper. It was something very, very mysterious and harmful. We knew that virus caused polio. We knew that virus caused many diseases. How could we combat them? What was this mysterious thing? How did you get the viruses? With the advent of the electron microscope, this was actually, first microscopes were built in the late 1930s and 1940s. These early electron microscopes were probably not even as good as the light microscope. But the important thing was the principle, you see, the fact that you could potentially, with more refined techniques, get a magnification some 100 to 1,000 times that of the light microscope, or even 100,000 times. With this magnification, then, with the electron microscope and with the refined techniques, particularly in the 50s, we photographed the first viruses, and we now know what a virus looks like, and we know a lot more about viruses, which I'll tell you about. We know a considerable bit about their structure and composition. So no longer is a virus an unknown, mysterious thing that it can pass through a filter. The reason it passes through the filter is that it is so tiny. It is very, very minute, and it is, if it is living, we might say that virus is the smallest living thing. It's debatable whether a virus is a living thing. I'll talk about that in a bit. But you're probably familiar with viruses in the respect that they can cause disease, and many of our diseases, common diseases, are virus diseases. Smallpox, chickenpox, polio, common cold, and so on. Many of these we've been able to combat by preventative medicine, in other words, by means of vaccination. If you can introduce a small amount of the virus, or living or dead virus actually will function, then your body will build up, the blood will build up antibodies against this foreign substance you've introduced. And then as this occurs, your body builds up more and more of these antibodies. Then, supposing you did somehow come in contact with a real polio virus, then your antibodies that you already have will immediately go and kill off or inactivate this polio virus that you have come in contact with, and you do not get the disease. On the other hand, if you did not have the vaccination, then you would not have the antibodies, and you see the virus couldn't attack you. Of course, this is great. Why don't we do this with a common cold? You know, all of us are suffering one time or another from a common cold. Some of us have maybe three or four in the course of a winter. And wouldn't it be great if we could have a vaccination, you see, and no more common cold? Same thing with influenza, flu, which is a virus infection. Or, you know, good old stomach flu, I could do without that, you know, once or twice a year, too. So apparently in England a few years back, they started experimenting with the common cold to see if they could develop a vaccine for the common cold. Now, the real problem is trying to keep the thing in culture. If you're going to work with an organism to try to develop a vaccine for it, you have to have the organism in culture and develop your vaccine from that organism. However, they had extreme difficulty keeping the common cold virus in culture. And just when they thought they had it, and wrote a paper about it, then just as quickly it disappeared. And when people came to see about this cold virus that they had in culture, it was not to be seen. It was gone. And this does great things. One of the things about when you publish, you must be able to demonstrate all that you have done. You know, and many people will immediately ask for your cultures and for your procedure and will, you know, repeat it. And it cannot be accepted unless it's repeatable. So this is rather embarrassing, you know, the cold virus disappeared completely. But they did recover it later on, and apparently what seemed to be the problem was they were using too much heat. Apparently the cold virus does not grow well at 98.6, if they assumed it would. Most of the bacteria grow best at this temperature. Apparently it grows better at slightly lower temperatures, something like 92 or 93 degrees Fahrenheit. And this is why we find the cold virus associated with areas in which there's probably external air coming in that cools it down, you see. So probably you're inside the nose and throat area. It is probably not 98.6, you see. It's probably slightly cooler, and the cold virus does pretty well, I would say. Okay, well, what about your experiments with the virus? They're rather interesting. We all have our little ideas of how you get a cold, and I have mine too. And they found that in most of their studies that the important thing in getting the cold was the fact that you had to be exposed to the cold virus. You know, you all hear somebody saying, gee, last night somebody left the window open, you know, and in the window maybe of the car, otherwise in this draft on my neck all evening long, and gee, now I've got a horrible cold and stiff neck. Or, you know, Johnny, don't get your feet wet. If you stand in the gutter and you get your feet wet, you'll surely pick up a cold the next day, and maybe Johnny does. If he doesn't, you forget about it. But if he does get the cold, it's because his feet were wet and he was standing in the gutter. It reminds me of an interesting thing. If you open the window, it's fresh air. If somebody else opens the window, it's a draft. Well, anyway, it's this kind of thing about a cold. You will get the cold if you have been exposed to the cold virus. Of course, there's another factor involved. Here's your own body resistance. You will get the cold if you've been exposed to the cold virus and if your body resistance is such that you can't throw off that cold virus. Maybe you're in a tip-top condition. You've had lots and lots of sleep, like you're a student in a school, you know, and you know how it is. You just get loads of sleep, eating 10 hours a night, and excellent nutrition, eat all sorts of good foods. Then you don't get the cold. But if you haven't had enough sleep and you're pretty run down and maybe you've been living on potato chips and crackers, chances are you will not be able to throw off the cold. But at any rate, to get the cold, you must be exposed to the virus. In conclusion, will we be able to get a vaccine for the common cold? It's doubtful. Apparently the experiments that they performed seem to indicate that it is not one cold virus, but probably maybe 10, 15, or 20, or who knows, maybe more than that. Which would mean even if they did develop a vaccine, you'd need at least 15 or 20 vaccinations. And then the other problem, which is probably even worse, is the fact we're not even sure we build up antibodies against the cold virus. So even after 20 vaccinations, you wouldn't even build up any antibodies, so you see, I have a problem here. So we need another attack, which I'll tell you about in a bit, about what is a way in which the body gets over so-called virus infections, and perhaps what might be a way which we can presumably in the future use as a means to combat virus infections. I might mention here antibiotics, which you're familiar with, penicillin, streptomycin, tetracycline, terramycin, a whole bunch of these, do nothing for a virus infection. we don't really have any single thing. Aha, you've got a cold. Here, take this little thing and it'll get rid of the cold. Sure, you go to the doctor and he says take cough medicine and get lots of fluids and take some aspirin and, you know, you'll get over the cold. But he isn't really giving you anything that will help that virus. In other words, whether you take what he gives you or you don't, probably won't make a second difference. I mean, in my opinion, drinking the fluids is probably more to keep you busy than anything else. Whether it actually does much for the cold, I mean, fluids are fine, but whether it really helps you that much get over the cold, that's sort of debatable.
What are the cold shots that doctors prescribe? Are they sort of a shot in the dark that there may be one or two or three of the viruses causing colds are being covered by these shots?
They might be giving you gamma globulin type of thing, which helps your body to resist disease, or it could be, the flu shots that we have, these things, in other words, they will work against certain of the viruses. Doesn't mean that you won't get a flu bug, but it will prevent you from getting some flu bugs, or may ameliorate the symptoms of what you do get. It's probably the kind of thing. Yeah.
You know, when you're talking about cold breaths and going out in the rain, that's not really causing the cold with the virus, but isn't it possible that the virus could be latent within your body and the cold air, the chills, and whatever you've got?
Let's put it lowered resistance.
Okay.
If this does lower your resistance to a point, in other words, if you get really tired or, you know, from this kind of thing, yes, conceivably. So if whatever you do lowers your resistance, now maybe running 10 miles and then, you know, being real sweaty and exhausted and being in a down condition, this could do it. But I would say the clue is lowered resistance, if what you do should lower your body resistance. Yes. How do we get over virus infections? Apparently the cells in the body produce a substance that's called interferon. And this substance does combat virus infection. So all your cells produce the substance. When you get over a virus infection, it is this that generally gets you over the infection. It is not the buildup of antibodies in the blood. Apparently it takes about 2 weeks for the blood to build up sufficient antibodies to kill off a virus, and you see the cold doesn't last that long, and it does, you know, you're in bad straits, and you probably have something other than a cold. Normal cold will last for about a week, and that's it. If it lasts longer than that, chances are you have something other than a cold. So interferon is the substance that the cells in the body begin to produce to combat this virus infection. Well, you see the obvious conclusion is, then, well, why don't we somehow get a lot of interferon, then you take a little pill of interferon, and he'll be in good shape. The only problem is, the only way we can get interferon is either from human cells or from monkey cells, and monkeys apparently aren't much more abundant than humans. And to get enough commercially apparently is not feasible. So that seems to be out. Plus the problem of, you know, when you take something extraneous other than from what your cells have produced, your own cells have produced, there's a danger of allergic reactions and toxicity. What they're working on now, rather than introducing somebody else's interferon, what they're working on now is to ways to promote your interferon production by trying various things which will promote your interferon production. So maybe in the future you may hear of something like this that you will take that will help you get over a virus infection. It might be effective kind of thing. Let me tell you what a virus is, what it looks like, and how it behaves, so then you can understand what happens when you have a regular virus infection. Then I will try to relate this to cancer. I've said nothing about cancer yet. I want to first introduce what virus is, then how a virus could cause cancer. Okay, the virus has many different shapes, and some of them are sort of broad shaped like this. Some of them have very complex geometric shapes. Rather interesting one that has been studied frequently is the T-series virus. And we call them bacteriophages. In short, for short, we use this phage. These are the virus that eat bacterial cells. Phage means eater of bacteria.
These are the kinds of viruses that we study most frequently because a virus to culture, it must have living tissue. And it's much easier to use bacteria as the cells you're going to eat up or destroy rather than human cells or some other kind of cell. Of course, we do grow virus in very often in chicken embryos. But a very good way of studying virus is the bacterial virus. And this is what we know the most of, the incident looked at under the electron microscope and otherwise. Well, the structure that I describe of this virus is more or less typical of all your virus. The outside of the virus is a protein coat. The outer structure may be varying. In some of these T4 series of virus, you have little prongs here that enable the virus to attach to the cell, the cell that the virus is attaching to. The comparison size of a bacterial cell, and incidentally, a bacterial cell is not large. How many of you have seen bacterial cell under the microscope? Many of you have. Even under 1,000 power of the microscope, which is really high power, many of your bacterial cells look just like a very tiny line, barely visible. So the bacterial cell, if you look at it, does not look like this. I've blown it up. This is an electron microscope view of a bacterial cell. The virus, in comparison to that, is about like that on the cell. So now you have a relationship. That's why you can't see the virus under the microscope, because all you see under the microscope is that, and you're certainly not going to see this thing on top of that. So this is why we have never seen virus before the advent of the electron microscope. What happens is, this virus then attaches to the cell. The bacterial cell has a cell wall, so it needs to attach very firmly. Inside this virus, coiled very, very tightly, is a substance that we call DNA. Last week I spoke about DNA and what it is. DNA is the really molecule of life. Without DNA, there would be really no life, no reproduction, and otherwise. DNA is present in human cells or cells of other higher organisms. It is present inside the nucleus of the cell. And it contains all the information, all the hereditary information necessary to produce an individual. In other words, I could take a cell from the inside of your cheek. There would be a nucleus in that cell, and that nucleus has all the information necessary to make another you. And this thing has actually been done with frogs. They have taken cells from the intestines of a frog, they've taken the nucleus and have from that grown another frog. So all of the information is coded on this molecule of DNA. Well, obviously the DNA in a human cell is a very, very long molecule squeezed into this nucleus. The DNA in the virus is quite a bit smaller because you see the virus is much smaller than would be the nucleus of a human cell. However, the DNA within this protein coat contains all the information necessary to build another virus. Just like the DNA in your nucleus has all the information to grow a complete individual. All right, let's go back to the virus. So, we've got a protein coat and we have this DNA. What happens? Apparently, the virus attaches to the cell. It injects this DNA into the cell. So then, what you have now is this protein coat sitting on the outside of the cell and the virus DNA in here. All right, this protein coat is of no further function. It is merely a house for the DNA, that's all. The protein coat falls away and nothing more of that happens. This is the shell that drops off, like a snake skin, you know. Okay, so that is of no more value now. What happens next? This DNA from the virus has been injected into this big bacterial cell. The bacteria has its own DNA, which I'll symbolize here. This is DNA of the bacteria. The bacteria DNA, of course, has all the information to keep the bacteria functioning. But when this virus DNA enters, apparently, the information on this is sufficient to cause bacterial cells to stop any work for bacteria, and immediately
what it does, breaks up this DNA, and it ends up in reproducing virus DNA, and as a matter of fact,
whole complete new viruses. From the material ingredient in the bacterial cell, we then build up not 2, 3, or 4 viruses, but perhaps as many as 200 or 300 viruses within this bacterial cell. And it doesn't take several hours either. As a matter of fact, this has been known to occur in as short as 20 minutes.
So if we think that bacteria can reproduce fantastically well, once you get to a virus, 200 in 20 minutes is not bad. And each one of these, at the end of 20 minutes, the cell breaks up. There's nothing left but virus inside it. The cell breaks up and releases all of these virus particles, and each can then again go and attack another cell. So a virus infection, this is why you can get a virus infection very quickly, you know. 1 hour you'll feel good, 3 hours later you have the worst cold you think you ever had, you know. It can come on quickly. All right. This is what we call a virulent infection, meaning that it is very active. The virus particles are attacking the cell. The cells are rupturing and releasing the virus particles. When you have a virulent infection, you can test the tissue and you can get virus particles out. In other words, you can tell that that it is a virulent infection. One of the hang-ups causing the failure to recognize virus as a cause of cancer results from Koch's postulates. These were developed in the 1700s or 1800s and were a clue to identifying an organism as a cause of disease. They've been extremely helpful in implicating various bacteria causes of diseases. So for Koch's postulates then, here, basically, to prove that an organism is the cause of a disease, you must find the organism in the disease tissue. You must be able to take that organism out, grow it in pure culture, inject it into healthy tissue, and produce the disease. All right, fine. We can do that with many virus diseases. We can do that with bacterial disease. The problem is cancer. But in cases of cancer, we have not found a free virus that you can take out and inject into another organism and produce cancer, at least for that tissue. Initially, this was not possible. So this is why many people claim, particularly in the 30s, 40s, and even 50s, perhaps into the 60s, that virus was not a cause of cancer. Evidence now very strongly suggests that virus can be one cause of cancer, certainly not the only cause. But let me mention now how this can occur, and it's because of another way that virus can act within the cell. And this is called a temperate infection. Here's our bacterial cell again, and here's the virus. I'll make it big enough so you can see it, even though it's out of proportion. The same thing happens, it shoots its DNA into the cell. Proteins are released from the outside. However, instead of this DNA causing some 200 virus to be produced, this DNA can attach to the host DNA, the DNA of the bacterium. But then, you've got this cell with its own chromosome plus a little added bit of DNA from the virus. What happens then? It may or may not cause the bacteria cell to change visibly, you know, physiologically. There's some cases in which the change in the bacterial cell has been rather drastic. I mentioned on Monday the fact that the Streptococcus bacteria, if it has a virus within it, will give you scarlet fever. In other words, the presence of the virus causes the production of an extra toxin and you get scarlet fever instead of the strep throat. Another case occurs in the organism causing diphtheria. Apparently, the bacteria itself will not give you diphtheria unless it has a virus within it, a particular virus within it. So, in some cases, the virus within the cell can cause the cell to behave differently. In other cases, there seem to be no change within the cell. Another interesting thing, it is possible for this virus within the cell suddenly to at a later date to become virulent and behave like a virulent infection. In other words, to become at a later date a cause and production of the regular virus particles in the cell. What can trigger this, we don't know. Could be some environmental factors such as radiation or otherwise. But apparently this can occur. Alright, now let me relate now this to cancer. First I'd like to describe what cancer is and what possibly could cause a cancer condition. We consider cancer as an abnormal condition of the cells. These cells behave abnormally. Normally these cells will, certain cells will divide, but they will not continue to divide ad infinitum. They will, after division, some of them will mature and perform a function. In the case of a cancer, you have a kind of growth resembling that of the bacteria. If you have one cancer cell, this will divide and you've got two cells. Instead of either of these maturing, they will both divide and you've got four cells, and again, eight cells, 16 cells, and so on. Cancer cell does not necessarily divide rapidly. It will probably divide at the rate that those cells normally would divide. But the point is they don't mature, and they'll continue to divide. Pretty soon you'll have a large mass. If the cell doesn't divide particularly rapidly, it might take a matter of 2 to 3 years before you get maybe a million cells. But then at that point, then in a day, maybe they divide once a day. In one day you'd have 2 million. Another a day later, 4 million. And a day later, 8 million. And something like this. So you see, once the cancer or tumor is visible, chances are it will go rapidly from that point, but it's up to the point of being visible, you see. It can remain hidden for a long period of time. One of the other problems of cancer is the fact that once it reaches a certain size, cancer cells don't adhere together. They behave abnormally in the respect that they just break off, and pretty soon you may have cancer cells traveling through the bloodstream. This is why when they operate, they will remove the adjacent lymph node, hoping to pick up any cancer cells that may have escaped into the system. Okay, a cancer then is a condition in which cells are dividing. They're behaving abnormally. Why do they behave abnormally? This we don't know. But it must be some genetic difference within the cell itself that it does not mature, it continues to divide. So really, the problem is within the cell itself. And what? It must be the DNA. Something has altered the DNA. What can alter the DNA? There are many, many things that can alter DNA. We know that radiation can alter DNA. We know that radiation can, in certain cases, induce a cancer, probably by this kind of means. Certain chemicals can alter DNA. And here is where we have the implication of smoking and lung cancer. Here the continual exposure to the tars can probably promote alteration and ultimately a cancer. And then lastly, virus could be a cause of altering DNA. How could a virus alter DNA? You see, the virus introduces its own DNA. For supposing now the virus that has entered the cell is a temperate virus. It attaches to the host chromosome. In this case, if you were to make a cell study, you would not see any free virus. Why not? The virus are within the host chromosome. You could not observe them in culture otherwise. The virus brings its own DNA into the cell. The information that it brings might be such to cause reproduction of DNA, which is obviously what happens when a virus enters a cell. What happens? DNA is reproduced. Normally, it is the virus DNA that's reproduced. But if the virus is attached to the host chromosome, it would be the host chromosome and all that would reproduce. And once you have reproduction of DNA, the cell must divide. And this is probably what happens. We don't know how much DNA or what particular genes are necessary, but maybe as few as 2 or 3 genes could be sufficient to cause reproduction of 2 or 3 genes to be sufficient to cause the DNA of the cell to reproduce. And once this happens, the cell must divide. And so you could have then a beginning of a cancer. Some studies that indicated this type of thing were carried on recently, working with animals in which they injected virus into animals and produced tumors. This is our first evidence, good evidence really, that virus was a valid cause of cancer. Most of the early studies, however, when they introduced the virus, it took some time for the cancer to develop, and it did not necessarily develop at the same site at which the virus was introduced. However, later they developed, found a virus that did cause a cancer right at the site of injection within a very short period of time. This seemed to be a clue to a cancer-causing virus, since it caused it directly. Studying this, it was most interesting. They found that this particular virus was incomplete. It was incapable of behaving in a virulent manner. Apparently, it was missing some gene. Somehow or other, the virus was incomplete. They found that if they introduced at the same time another virus that enabled it to become complete, then it behaved in a virulent manner. So apparently, it was missing two or three or two genes that caused the reproduction of the virus and the protein code and all. So instead, it caused merely reproduction of the host chromosome and then the cancer condition. So conceivably then, maybe cancer could be a cancer virus that may have once been, or could have been, a measles or chickenpox virus, or who knows what kind of virus, but it was incomplete, and so it was incapable of behaving the way it should, and instead it entered the cell, remained there, and could cause a cancer. What can we do for cancer, and knowing that cancer then is the real cause, is within the chromosome, it's within the DNA itself, what possibly can be used to combat it? Perhaps the best, one of the best ways, of course, is to operate, if you can get it early enough, operate and remove the cancer completely. But the problem here is if you don't remove it completely, you just have to leave one cancer cell, and what if you've got 2, 4, 8, 16? And if you have one, maybe the travel to one part of the body and one to another part of the body, you know, and it's very possible and very frequently happens that even after they have operated about 2 years later, 3 years later, then it appears sort of all throughout the body. And it's probably what has happened. In operating, one can move the adjacent lymph nodes and hope that maybe we'll catch all these great cancer cells. The other thing we can do is radiation. Radiation, the value of radiation, is perhaps in hoping maybe to remove the cancer cells. It cannot be ever considered a guaranteed cure in any sense. Radiation. The theory behind this is the fact that we know that radiation affects most frequently are cells that are dividing. Okay. So if you give X radiation to cells that are dividing, it will harm them and perhaps kill them. So the theory is now, okay, in a cancer, most of your cells are dividing, so why don't we give it a lot of radiation and maybe we can remove all these cancer cells. Two problems with that. One is that many cancer cells become resistant to radiation, so you have to use extremely high dosages with their effects on the rest of the body if they're not necessarily desirable. Problem number two is you can never be sure that you've killed all the cancer cells. And problem three is you cannot be sure that you will not induce a cancer in a healthy cell. You will naturally harm normal cells, and there is always the possibility that you will not only harm the normal cell, but you will cause the normal cell to become cancer. So you see, there are problems in use of radiation, and in most cases cannot give an effective cure, but it certainly can alleviate symptoms for a period of time. So drugs, same kinds of problems. The drugs would be drugs intended to, again, kill cancer cells and act on chromosomes. And again, there could probably be the same kind of problem. Overall, bodies would seem to affect if you could get some drugs, and then again, possibilities of for the reaction. About a cure for cancer, another kind of cure, which we don't know, presumably maybe the kind of thing would be infecting maybe cancer cells with a virus, bringing information that would alter or counteract the information that's causing the reproduction. Maybe we could somehow send in the information to complete the information of that virus, so it would behave in a virulent manner, we need to get rid of it, rather than being this insidious back in the little cell. So, this is just airing some ideas about virus and cancer, so I think I'll just be a bit open now.
I think the cancer is more susceptible to be treated than
One would be location. Perhaps nature of the cancer itself, and if you catch it quick enough, then it's much easier. If you let it go too far, then you see, there's very little hope. But if you can get it at an early stage, and this is why we emphasize, being alert and looking for any signs of cancer, try to get it at an early stage. And if you do symptoms, you certainly go to a doctor and have a biopsy or otherwise. Then the whole prognosis is good.
Are there different types of cancer?
This we don't know. There are probably different kinds. In other words, the cell is always divided. But what is the information of what happened to it? It could be a different kind of gene. So maybe to combat it might be a different gene. But in any case, if it is a cancer, it will be divided. And of course, there are probably different ways. It might be different virus that might attack different, it might attack different parts of the body. Just as it is with viruses for regular infections. One kind of virus would give you a cold, another kind of virus is the flu virus, or a different virus.
Benign cancer, is there an abnormal growth that does not have the characteristics of the cancer cell?
Yes, a benign tumor would be one that that it's an abnormal growth, but it tends to reach a point where it doesn't grow any further, then it tends to become encapsulated. It does not break apart and spread through the body.